Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Peter Levine with us for a talk about an issue of civics and education. I'll introduce him as the Dean of Research at Tufts University. He really is a humanist in the broad sense of the word. I was looking over your CV, Professor Dean Levine, welcome, Peter.
Thank you.
I see your first book was on Nietzsche and the modern crisis of the humanities, and that crisis is still with us, isn't it?
That's right.
Modern. Right. you also, more recently, you've written a book called We Are the Ones We Have Been Waiting For, The Promise of Civic Renewal in America. That was Oxford University Press from 2013. Reforming the Humanities, Literature, and Ethics from Dante Through Modern Times. Small topic there, Peter.
Yeah.
Palgrave Macmillan.
Small readership, too.
The Future of Democracy, Developing the Next Generation of American Citizens. That was with Tufts University. Have you been with Tufts most of your career?
No. I've been here for 10 years.
Okay.
But actually, that book was before I got here. So previously, I was at University of Maryland for 15.
Great. Okay. Oh, and was Circle? Well, I'll get into Circle in a moment. Anyway, Peter is also a civics expert, not only as a researcher, but as an educator as well. And he's very involved in civics education. And one of the research projects, a very important research project that I've borrowed upon for many years, is called CIRCLE. That's the acronym for it. And it was it housed at the University of Maryland when you were there?
Yes.
And then it moved to Tufts University. You were a director there, and now you oversee its project. But why don't you go ahead and tell us what CIRCLE is?
Well, at one level, it's the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement, civicyouth.org. And it's a research center, and it's based now at Tufts, and it studies young Americans. That means teenagers, even sometimes children, up through 20-somethings. And it studies their civic engagement. So that's voting and volunteering and community service, but it's also following the news and participating in social movements and a whole range of actions. And it's a very applied research center, not a bunch of tenure track faculty members, but a bunch of researchers who try to actually be helpful to constituencies.
And you're out there. I said I've borrowed the data. It is really strong. It is really strong numbers that you provide. For people who do want to sort of go public and speak about what's going on and give a good empirical base for the youth. And one of the things that you track every election that many people pay attention to, I actually think Pew does this as well. I think your data are better than Pew's data, but just between us. And that is the youth participation in the vote. What was the youth voting? Youth voting defined what 18 to 29-year-olds. Or also, do you break it down to 18 to 24-year-olds as well?
We will ultimately, but we can't based on the evidence that we have right now. So right now we're talking 18 to 29-year-olds. And the magic number is 31%, we think, voted. There's some uncertainty about that.
In the midterm?
In the midterm.
Which is, you know, I heard the current director on the radio a few days before the election who was predicting that there was going to be some remarkable youth turnout in this midterm election. And while a lot of our listeners might think 31%, that's kind of disappointing, it's actually an extraordinary bump off past midterms, correct?
Yeah, I think it's both disappointing and a tremendous bump up. I mean, it depends on, you know, the glass is 31% full. So, on one hand, I think it would be better if we had a Republican, which a lot more than 31% of a whole age cohort voted. On the other hand, and compared to any other country with a well-functioning democratic system, it's very low. On the other hand, it was a lot up, about 10 percentage points or so. And I think that change will definitely turn out to be true when other data come in. I think 31% number itself is a little squishy, but the change is very pronounced and up. And
I remember it in the high teens in previous midterm elections from what I saw, which itself was terribly disappointing. But so I have to be optimistic.
Yeah,
about the 31%.
Yeah, and it defeats it rebuts kind of fatalism, because there was something kind of depressingly consistent actually about the midterm youth voting rate. It's kind of an interesting little quick digression. It's just it's been until this year, the midterm youth voting turnout rate was very flat, going all the way back to the 1970s. And that actually, that flatness actually requires some kind of explanation, which I don't really have for you. But it's a mystery, because
it didn't change from generation, even though generations changed, it didn't change.
Everything changed. I mean, the nature of the nature of the political, you know, the debates, what's on the table politically for us as a country, but also, yes, the generations, the demographics of the, of young people have changed dramatically. The media. So from the era of Walter Cronkite to the era of Twitter, it was exactly the same turnout. But then it just bumped up. And so I think that makes you realize that it can change. And if you want to get it up to some reasonable level, you got to do it, you know, 10 percentage points at a time would be a pretty good rate of improvement. So, yeah, I thought it was very good.
Do you yourself have any want to speculate about the reasons why it went up 50% roughly?
Well, I mean, I think part of the reason is clearly Donald Trump. Some young people voted in support of him and said so in the exit polls. A whole bunch of them voted against him because they really, really don't like him. And it's not only directly Donald Trump, but also the attention given to the election because of the stakes perceived from this administration was much higher. So one of the reasons that the midterm's lower than the general always is because you just get less. It's possible to go through a midterm election cycle without seeing much about the election. Right. But this one was nationalized and brought to everyone's attention. I'd like to think there's also some positive impact from a lot of people who are actually working in a nonpartisan way and hard and carefully to get young people involved in politics. And I do think they deserve some of the credit, but the 11-point boost, I think you have to attribute substantially to the president.
And the breakdown Democrat and Republican this time?
Unprecedentedly Democratic in the whole history of youth voting. So I think it was, didn't memorize, I think it was 68% Democratic, which was higher than the percent that Barack Obama got in the 2008 election, and
wow,
never seen before. And, you know, one myth is that, well, young people vote Democratic, and then maybe they get a little more conservative as they get older. Actually, as recently as 2000, the youth vote was almost exactly split 50-50.
Huh.
George Bush lost it to Al Gore, but by just a hair, and he had been behind in the polls. So it's not a permanent feature. This is quite a striking situation. And if you're a Republican, if one is a Republican, one should be very alarmed, because
if that holds, I mean, it's doom.
It is. It's pretty much doom. There's a sort of myth in the political consultant class that if a person votes three times for the same party, they vote that way the rest of their life. I actually think that I haven't been able to run down persuasive evidence that's really based in data. But it's kind of common sense that if a whole generation votes 68% for the Democrats, that the Republicans are in trouble.
I look at that and I hear that and I think, wow, that's I'm surprised that there was only a loss of what, 35 seats. I can't remember what we're at now. Mid-30s, high-30s. They lost.
I think
got to 40. Yeah, or yeah. 40. Okay.
Yeah. I think you got to 40 by the time you got the California seats. Yeah.
And Circle. Circle wants to see the broader civics, not just politics. They want to see the broader civics picture and civic activity that includes volunteer work. Do you try to test civic knowledge?
We're very interested in it. I'm not sure that I could say we test it, because there are some other tests out there.
Oh, like right. The NAEP exams.
Actually, I'm on the committee to help write the questions for that. But Circle isn't really in the business of doing the test. But we're very interested in knowledge as an outcome, for sure. And mm-hmm. try to understand who has it and why. And yeah.
So if you're part of the NAEP, this is the National Assessment of Educational Progress. It's the it's part of the research wing of the U.S. Department of Education that gives the tests, the NAEP exams, as they're called, the Nation's Report Card exams, and civics is one of them. When we give the test to 12th graders, we're usually around maybe 30 to 40% score proficient or advanced. Is that correct?
Yeah, but hardly any score advanced.
Yeah. So okay. Yeah.
What you said was true, but it's almost all taken up by the proficient group.
And yeah. And then we have basic and below basic. Basic is about 40. How many score below basic, I should say?
Once again, typically. I remember, but the biggest group is the basic, and the proficient group is a minority of about a third.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. And what we want is because democracy functions through the sovereignty of the people, and because we need people to make informed decisions and to know what those guys in power are up to, we need good, strong civic knowledge. Good yeah. civic education.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. And, you know, and I volunteer for the, well, actually they pay me hourly, but I work for the NAEP, and I agree with you. I mean, I would just for people's interest not to disagree, I would throw out a couple of complications. I mean, one is there's no current events whatsoever on the NAEP. It's all perennial. So mm-hmm. it's a different, so I don't think people do all that well on current events questions either, but it's different. And the other thing is that the breakpoints for what counts as basic, proficient, and advanced are completely and utterly arbitrary,
yeah.
or they're
yeah.
they're a matter of pure judgment. And yeah. I think some people. The only mistake that I would throw out there is that I think some people hear those numbers and assume that if most people can't reach proficient, then most people are complete ignoramuses,
yeah.
and they might
yeah.
be surprised by how hard the questions are. The questions are actually pretty detailed and pretty hard, and so they might be consumers of those statistics might be underestimating how much kids know, but
yeah.
They don't know enough.
No, it is important to look at the content of those questions, and they can get. I have looked in there for the 12th graders, they can get pretty common, and the U.S. history questions, you know, questions about the Korean War, for instance, that kids don't perform well on, but. You know, the Korean War isn't that might be a pretty remote subject for everyone to get. But in terms of civics education, where do you think we stand in public education or private education too? Because private school students take the NAEP as well. Where do we stand on civics education in America today?
I think it's a backwater. It's been a low priority. It has not been featured in any of the waves of education reform that have come across education in general over the last 30 years.
No Child Left Behind had nothing about civics. Yes.
Right. Basically didn't mention it. If you do a word search, you'll find something, but it's because of leftover previous legislation.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, A Nation at Risk, the report that kicked off a lot of ed reform, is actually explicitly about civics right at the beginning. That's forgotten. So I think it's a backwater. I also think that sort of another bullet point I would throw out there is that civics has got to be different for the 21st century because we're teaching kids to navigate a world of social media and political polarization and other features so that even if we were doing it as well as we had been doing it in the 1960s or 50s, it would have to be changed. So those are critical points, and other things could be said that are critical. It's also very unequal. So some kids are actually getting a pretty good civics education and other kids are not. It's not quite as bad as I find most adults think, because I find most adults think that we don't teach civics anymore. You know, I took civics when I was a kid and I can't believe it. They don't teach civics anymore. Right. But actually, every single state has civic standards, and 43 states have a required course, and it's not zero, and it's not clearly less than it was 20 mm-hmm. years ago.
Mm-hmm. But the emphasis is so heavy on first of all math and reading, right?
Yeah.
Those test scores and the devotion of resources which go to those subjects, they kind of just eclipse the, you know, not only the arts, but also in the arts and the civics area as well, and sort of the utilitarian approach even the utilitarian approach to reading. It's all about reading skills, right?
Yep.
Math skills. And civics is so much about content. First of all, knowledge of, you know, well, what's in the Constitution and the First Amendment, but also about the conduct of citizens. You know, what are the rights and responsibilities of being a citizen in the United States? Does that get us into maybe some complicated or even controversial issues that some people shy away from in education discussions or education reform?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the reasons that science, for example, STEM education has had more success as a field than civics, my little field of civics, is that there's less controversy for science. I mean, the outcomes are less controversial. There's some controversy around the edges, around how science should deal with contested issues like abortion or something, but it's really, a lot of it's, everybody agrees. And civics is gonna be, and ought to be, controversial. It's about what kind of political order we want to create for the next generation. And you can sidestep some of that. You should sidestep some of that by being pluralist and letting people define it different ways, and also by letting kids navigate them to some extent their own way through contested issues. But you can't escape some controversy. And in fact, it would be kind of creepy if we didn't have controversy about civics.
Right, right.
So I'm not afraid of it, but I do think it's one of the challenges for doing civics. Even something like a test, right? We were talking about NAEP. So one of the ways that civics is behind other fields is it's not much assessed. But once you sit down and start writing an assessment, it's much more, there's controversy sort of shot through it in a way that's not true in for STEM.
And you're part of those processes. You have a lot of arguments in that room, in that committee room there, Peter, when you're devising questions and the wording of those questions?
Yeah, not so much arguments
to be
truthful. It's not really arguments, but I think one thing that happens is everybody tries to do their best, including me, to sort of scrape questions for their, you know, potential controversy,
right.
You know, or for bias, for political bias, right?
Right.
And whatever the group thinks, we're trying to think what other people would think. And I fear that the result is a very anodyne survey with a lot of questions just cut because somebody says, but couldn't you say, what if you were a very strong libertarian? Wouldn't you agree that actually the role of the government is not what we said it was? You know, you can't pick choice C, because if you're a really strong libertarian, it isn't C. So then we
cut
the question.
Right.
Right. So I think that's what happens more
right.
than anything else. There's a lot of, I'm sure there's also a lot of political bias. If you were a skeptical, critical reader, you could find bias. But subjectively, what I feel is more a somewhat debilitating effort to avoid political bias.
Hmm. And I see that. I've done some test development in English, and you know, the selection of passages.
Yeah.
They've got to get through that bias review panel. And you always err on the side of hyper-caution.
Yeah.
I mean, if we can pick something else that isn't going to raise this particular little issue in these couple of sentences, why not just do that, right?
Yep.
And you just want to stay out of trouble. And I mentioned school board members and chief state school officers. They don't want trouble, right? Dude, you know, controversy is... It takes time and energy. It can go poorly for you in your career. It can become a campaign issue, but you're right. If civics has to have a lot of those complications and disagreements, because that's a pluralist society, right?
Yep.
That's inevitable. Well, you know we talked before about there being. A deep civic tradition in America. You said that no current events on the NAEP, but there are a lot of historical materials on there. Is there a set of books, a set of works, not books, documents that most students in America are asked to read in civics education?
Yeah, I was wondering if you were going to ask me how many kids actually read them as original text. I don't know the answer to that. I really am agnostic about it. I'm not sure how many. But I do think if you looked at the standards, and those are supposed to have the force of law, although they're not always that enforceable. But
and these are state-level standards, yes.
Yes. Because we actually went through all 50 and kind of coded them. I think the core, the common core of this, not with a capital C, is basically the key text around the American Constitution. So the Declaration, the Constitution, the Federalist Papers, although people don't read that many of those.
Right.
The reinterpretation of the Constitution through the Gettysburg Address, and then maybe Martin Luther King, the letter from Birmingham Jail, which is not exactly a reinterpretation of the U.S. Constitution, although it's partly is.
It's sort of part of the civic history now.
Yes.
It has that status.
Yes. And I think kids are required to learn that stuff. I'm not saying that they do, but that's the way the world works. I think kids are required to learn that stuff. I actually chafe a little at it because I guess I think it's actually a little too government centered. That is, it's taking the question to be how should we organize the national government and relate to it. And actually, I think there are questions about how we relate to each other and to community.
I've been writing about sort of civic knowledge and young people in the past. But I have never, ever thought about what you just said, but you're absolutely right. Why does civics education have to be so heavily government centered? And I'm not saying that as a libertarian. I'm not a libertarian, but I'm really, really saying that as that there are so much more things that go into our civic identity than law, right? Than regulations. What would that be, though?
Well, I'm pretty Tocquevillian. I mean, I think civic life is the most important. Civic life is in associations, in community. It's where we govern ourselves most directly, and it's also where we learn the most important virtues that we then apply when we do things like choose the president of the United States. It's the virtues that we learned when we associated with each other, and so I would emphasize that not only in so the traditional way to learn that is experiential, right? You learn to be a member of associations by associating, but I actually think there's also a rich theoretical and literary tradition about associational life.
And so Tocqueville would be one that on your syllabus.
Yeah, I promote Tocqueville and maybe even, I don't want to say I demote the Federalist Papers, but I would, Tocqueville, people should read, and Jane Addams and a bunch of figures.
Be specific, yeah. Jane Addams, go ahead and tell our listeners about Jane Addams a little bit.
Oh, the greatest American. No. Although she might be my favorite, but
not John Adams now, Jane Addams.
That's right.
Okay.
Did you know that Jane Addams' father was John Double D. Adams, who was a protege of Abraham Lincoln in the state legislature?
Really?
Of Illinois, or that Jane Addams taught Miles Horton, who taught Rosa Parks. So therefore, Rosa Parks is the great great grandchild of Abraham Lincoln intellectual.
There we are.
But she's the founder of the Hull House Settlement House in Chicago, whose life starts with just not knowing what value she has in a society, in broader society, because she's a highly educated woman without a career path, and just goes and moves into a poor neighborhood in Chicago with her wife, we now see it as her life partner. And they start programs, small programs that involve not changing other people, but interacting with them, create a museum to represent the local community. And it turns into a massive enterprise occupying a couple of square blocks of Chicago. And she writes beautifully about what she learns from the people there.
Hmm.
And then her buildings get flattened to build the high modernist University of Illinois Chicago, which is a perfect example of what went wrong. But
was there anything more devastating to civic life than mid-20th century high modernism?
Probably not. Especially, this is, I don't know if you know, but James C. Scott's argument that when you combine high modernism with a very weak civil society, you get totalitarianism.
Yeah.
So the high modernism is the arrogance of central planning and so on. But if you do that when you also have a pretty robust civil society, then it's okay because civil society uses the modernist vocabulary and it's fine. But if civil society is weak, then it's totalitarianism.
What is the, for our listeners, what is the title What is a title of Jane Addams that people could read to look up?
20 Years at Hull House.
20 Years at Hull House.
Okay. And it's a beautiful book because it's also autobiographical and because anybody who is trying to figure out what his or her own purpose in life is can resonate with young Jane Addams, with all of her talents and uncertainties.
Good. And you mentioned Tocqueville, so everyone should read at least portions of Democracy in America as part of that broader. What about John Dewey?
Yeah.
Any Dewey for civic understanding?
I always picture John Dewey standing by the fire of Hull House with Jane Addams, but Jane Addams wouldn't associate herself. He shouldn't put herself under the control of the University of Chicago, which he represented. So he had to come to her. But I teach John Dewey at the college level, and we end up criticizing him in many different ways. But he's definitely part of an American canon. And
could I ask? Give us a title of Dewey that people should look up.
The Public and Its Problems.
The Public and Its Problems.
1924. One way to present that is it's actually a rebuttal to, or it's an argument with Walter Lippmann, whose book is The Phantom Public. Very timely for the 21st century because Lippmann is saying the public can't govern because life is too complicated and because media is too powerful at brainwashing us. And Dewey says that's the correct diagnosis, but we've got to find a way through it.
That's 100 years ago. That debate should be revived in classrooms today.
Yep.
Because it's kind of relevant.
It sure is. And I'm not saying everybody should do it, but I actually do it with my college students. I don't mean to speak for them, but I think they uniformly think that the portions where Dewey lays out what's wrong are exactly to the word applicable to our current moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Are there jobs for civics teachers? Is it a job market out there for you go into a teacher training? Are you teaching in a teacher training program? A certification program at Tufts?
Tufts just is very undergraduate focused, and we don't have much of an education program. So no, my students are sort of learning to be citizens themselves, but they're not learning to teach it.
All the STEM teaching, you know, everyone needs more math and chemistry teachers at the high school level. If a young person was interested in civics and would think about being a civics teacher, is this something to advise?
I mean, in reality, you're probably going to be a social studies teacher, and one of your assignments is going to be to teach something called American government or civics.
Okay.
You're probably also going to teach history, and you might end up teaching some other social science. So, and your background could be, and it's fine with me if it is, American history, though I think there's a space also for basically political science in this. Yeah. So you're going to be a social studies teacher. And yeah, there's lots of social studies teachers. I mean, I'm not sure how the job market looks right now. One thing we have found is when a state ramps up its civics requirements, as Florida did, it actually creates demand for jobs. So
right.
There's a definite trickle down where the University of Florida system started producing more qualified social studies teachers because the state required a seventh grade course and a test.
Well, it's interesting. How you mentioned controversy. Look, everyone's talking, and there are all these books appearing about democracy in crisis in certain ways, and the American situation is really shaky when understood in civic terms. Now, in one sense, I can see this inspiring the push for more civics education in the schools, but on the other hand, it makes civics education a little more dicey.
Yeah,
and people are with the polarization. How do you manage that in the civics education world when you never know when someone's going to complain, parents are going to get angry, you're going to get journalists who are going to be writing about what you're doing. You see any answer there, or just do it?
Your description was very insightful and acute. I mean, it's both. It is an opportunity. For those people who are concerned about polarization and incivility and a breakdown of public life, civics is an answer because it's a place where we can teach kids to navigate this. And also the kids in some ways look, there are ways in which they look appealing. They actually, I think, are less polarized. Part of it is just a life cycle thing that they're less, because they're young, they're less rigid. But so that's one side. But the other side is if you if you are polarized, if you yourself read the world in polarized terms, then civics is a threat because you're bound to look at it as being dominated by people you don't agree with, or at least having that chance. And so then you're right. most likely to. So we get help from the anti-polarized people, but we get opposition from the polarized people is basically the story.
Interesting. Yeah, I can see that. Well, look, hey, Peter, I'm an English guy. I mean, I teach English literature, American literature at the college level. Any fiction or poetry that you would put on your civics syllabus?
Actually, I put a lot on, but I'll mention one for the sake of brevity, which is at the beginning of a advanced institute that I have taught for 10 years, we always read out loud and then discuss in some detail for quite a long time Seamus Heaney's poem In the Republic of Conscience, which he also bequeathed to Amnesty, the copyright to Amnesty International, so it's sort of their poem.
Heaney, In the Republic of Conscience.
In the Republic of Conscience. And it's the way you're actually an English professor, so don't judge me. But I'll tell you what I do, which is we first look at plot because it has a story and it's self-evident to people when the language is so beautiful that they think it's just a metaphor, but it's actually got a storyline, and we try to figure that out, and then we talk about why he's made the choice he's made, but we conclude by asking, are you a citizen of the Republic of Conscience? And I think it usually casts kind of a spell, because that's a kind of a haunting question.
You know, I just called it up online here, so people can look that up for themselves. Any Walt Whitman in there?
It should be. I have to say, I'm not a great reader of women. I mean, not that I've never read them in my life, but yeah. Yeah, I'm not ready to talk about Whitman. Do you teach Whitman?
Well, I teach Whitman, and actually I think that what you said about expanding civics beyond just the government documents, the founding and the direct commentary upon it into the broader sense of things. I mean, I've been had the position for a long time of doing American literature and feeling like your sense of the civic sphere really does have a little bit of Emerson in there, you know, a little bit of Thoreau.
Yes.
Even someone who had barely any civic existence at all, Emily Dickinson, she's now part of sort of the American sense of things. One argument I would make is to have that broader cultural reach for the civic understanding here. But
I only realized relatively recently that when Dewey ends The Public and Its Problems by saying we lie in the lap of an immense intelligence, that he's quoting Emerson.
Right.
But I think he's quoting him critically. That is, I think his idea is that in order to get release the immense intelligence, you have to be deeply engaged with other people and listening to them and so on. And Emerson is talking about self-reliance.
If we were all genuine Emersonians, there would be complete and total anarchy.
Yeah. So he's sort of the problem for Dewey, but it's worth hearing the echo, right? I didn't even recognize that Emerson was in Dewey's language there.
All right. Well, look, after the next election, can we have you on again, Peter?
Oh, anytime. Anytime. Okay. And thank you for having me. And I'd like to hear more about all your thoughts on these topics. You've been interviewing me, but I'm curious what you think.
Well, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.